The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 381 for Monday, February 13th, 2012.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions. You send in your tips. We try to answer your questions. We do our darndest. We try to share some tips of our own. Sometimes we talk about stuff that we've seen. Sometimes we talk about stuff that you've seen. Sometimes we do that and call it cool stuff found. Altogether, we are here to learn something new about the Mac and Apple products. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield. I haven't flubbed anything for a while, have I? Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Broad. Well, no, the reason I got confused, I have a tiny, well, I'm not the one that's confused, but I'll tell you why I flubbed that, because as you know, I just got started with Flickr.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, and I just took a photo today and they have this wonderful geocoding ability where if you include it, which I am with some of my photos, like on the iPhone, you can do that.
Right.
And I just took one this afternoon and it was clearly at a beach in Fairfield and Flickr identifies it as Grover Hill Bridgeport.
Interesting.
I mean, Bridgeport is the city next to Fairfield,
right.
But I sent in a support request. We'll see, because I don't know why their database insists that it's in Bridgeport. Again, it's close by, but the GPS, when it comes up on the map, it clearly lists the beach that I identified. You know, it says Jennings Beach and then it shows it right there. It's clearly in Fairfield. So I don't know why they're confusing that. Sometimes it says Fairfield. Sometimes it says Bridgeport. I don't know what database they're using. So if they can get confused, I can get confused. But on to the show.
No, that's a good, that's a perfect little topic to start with. Right. I mean, it's an interesting thing, the way all this geocoding works. I know we subscribe to a GeoIP based database for Backbeat Media so that we can do geo-targeting with our advertising if people want to do that or whatever. And for the most part, people just want to do country targeting and every now and then down to DMA, which is pretty well done. But DMA being what does DMA mean?
Direct Marketing Association?
Designated market area. So you'll have like a Chicago DMA and a New York DMA and a Boston DMA and that kind of thing. So, and sometimes they'll do that, but rarely do people actually want to target zip code, but we can look it up, you know, and by having access to this database, we can look it up, and regularly it puts my IP elsewhere. Excuse me. But that's very different from, you know, doing a GPS based location, which is what your phone is doing. And you'd think that would be more accurate, but I guess if their map is wrong, right? I mean, if their map says your coordinates, even if your phone gets the coordinates right, but whatever their map source is wrong, then they're in the same boat we are with the, you know, with the IP stuff. It'll say I'm in the town over, even though I'm right here. So it's all about your data, how accurate your database is. And I guess Flickr's isn't all that accurate. Or not perfectly accurate. We demand perfection from our service providers here.
Actually, you know, I'm looking here. So it's not, I thought it was, no, it's a data copyright 2010 Nav Tech, which I guess is one company that sells this data.
It's a big one.
So maybe
one,
it's a bug in their database or a bug in Flickr's. Well, I sent in a support request. We'll find out. They've acknowledged receipt of my request.
Isn't Nav Tech, wasn't Google using Nav Tech for a while? I mean, I think they do their own data now, but, yeah, Navtech is certainly one of the big ones. NAVTEQ, right? Is that right? Yeah, okay. Yep. All right, anyway, it's probably time to answer at least the first question in our little queue here. So let's go to, I'm doing this wrong. Hitting all the wrong buttons, John. It's going to be one of those shows, folks. But it, based on the pre-show that we had, it's going to be fun. So, we ran an article on TMO sometime last week about how Apple had released a firmware update for 2010 iMacs that allows internet recovery. And someone commented, and their question was something I thought would be great to discuss here, John. The question was, if the OS is messed up to the point where you need to recover, doesn't that usually mean you also don't have access to the internet? And so the conversation here that I want to have, and it'll either, I was going to say briefly, but it'll either be brief or it won't, is twofold. Number one, what is internet recovery versus the recovery partition in line? Because these are two different things. And then number two, why what Jack asked is not necessarily is based on a false assumption. So let's talk about Jack's question first, and then we'll talk about the nuances and the differences between these two recovery methods. So the reason that internet recovery in a general sense will work is that it does not rely on your operating system to do it. So Lion has two different things. So I guess we're going to blend the answers. It has internet recovery, and then it has the recovery partition. So the recovery partition is actually created when you install Lion, and it's put on your hard drive, but separate from the partition where you install all of your actual operating system. So even if your operating system is like totally FUBAR, as long as you can boot from the drive and get to the recovery partition, which is done by holding down, depending on the Mac, it's either R or Command R, but Command R will definitely get you there. Then from there, you can rerun the installer, and it's its own operating system. So even if you're pulling data down off the internet, which you will be if you reinstall, you're fine. Because as long as you've got an active internet connection in your location, either your house or your office or wherever you are, it's going to be able to do this. So that part's actually pretty cool. Anything we should add here, John, before I jump into the difference between internet recovery and recovery partition?
No, you're right. Command R. I just found the article about it.
Okay.
And we'll link to this article. It's useful. It tells you some of the facets of this new feature.
Yeah. So the thing is, though, there's also internet recovery, which is limited to only Macs that can support it. And now that's been expanded downward to the 2010 iMacs. And what internet recovery lets you do is it allows you to. This is weird. I'm realizing that my I am not synced with the latest version of my. Of my notes here, which is interesting, but that's okay. Internet recovery allows you to put a brand new hard drive in that has never had anything installed on it. And from the firmware of the computer, connect to the internet, download Lion and reinstall, and that's pretty cool to be able to do that from nothing and strictly from the internet. And so then Jack's follow-up question is, why isn't this available on all Macs? Why is it only down to 2010 iMacs? And my guess is that the EFI needs to be big enough to be able to do this, and perhaps older Macs don't have an EFI large enough. The firmware can't be made large enough to do that. That would be my guess. Any thoughts about this, John?
You know, one thing I noticed, this is something that I learned when I was fiddling with an SSD, and
yep.
And I didn't realize this. So here's a tip for everyone. If you are going to be doing a backup, especially a full backup with Carbon Copy Clone or another product to back up your hard drive, I found this out because what I did is I backed up my rotational hard drive to an SSD, and then I put it in to, you know, back into my MacBook Pro, and I'm like, oh, everything's exactly the same except for one thing. And I don't know why this is, but when I went to iCloud and then I went to find my Mac, for whatever bizarre reason, has a dependence in that if the recovery partition is not there, Find My Mac is not available.
Wow.
And it came up with some sort of error. It said, like, you know, recovery partition, it's not there, so you don't get this feature. It's like, why?
Huh. And it's,
I don't
tricky.
Know why I'm.
So what's the path if you've got Lion installed, like in that situation? How did you add the recovery partition?
Well, I didn't. I just ran that SSD without a recovery partition.
Okay.
And then when I went back, and then, yeah, when I was done with that drive, then I did a full copy from that one back to the original drive. And of course, that one had, you know, since I had installed Lion on it.
Right.
Yeah. So I basically just wiped out all the all the data. But something to keep in mind, if you are going to copy a line hard drive, make sure that you copy over that partition if you don't want to lose some functionality.
Yeah, that's good. Is there a way to rebuild? And I'm asked, I don't know the answer to this. Is there an easy way to rebuild that recovery partition if it doesn't exist?
I think like anything, I think you would have to, on the destination hard drive, create two partitions and use your tool of choice that can see that partition and copy it over.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very similar.
The partition doesn't exist anywhere. It's like built doing.
It's there. You just, it may be hard to see. Right? But some tools can see it. Like, they would
no. What I'm saying is if all you do is copy your main boot partition from one drive to another, how do you then add a recovery partition to that hard drive without having access to an existing recovery partition somewhere else?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think there's a way to do that other than, I guess if you reinstall Lion, then I guess that install a recovery partition for you. It sets the size a little, because I don't think it takes up a lot of space. It's pretty small.
Yeah, I'm looking at a couple of articles here about this, and you're right that, yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if the Lion Recovery Disk Assistant would add that. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. We gotta research this more. So we'll have an answer for this in the next show because that's good stuff.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Look at that. Lion Recovery Disk Assistant lets you create Lion Recovery on an external drive that has all the same capabilities it built.
Yeah.
I didn't even know about that.
Yeah. So that might be the way to do it.
Nice.
Thanks. Yeah, I stumbled onto that. But we'll do some more focused research when we're not in the middle of the show. And we'll report back next week. So there you go. So the differences between recovery partition is that lives on your hard drive, whereas internet recovery is burned into essentially the motherboard of your computer. And if your computer supports it, then you're in great shape, even if you lose your hard drive, because you still want a backup because you're going to want your data back. But as far as reinstalling the OS, you can just do that right from an internet connected computer that has no data on the hard drive whatsoever, which is pretty cool. All right. Moving on to Andy. Andy has here we go.
Hey guys, Andy Dolph calling from UNH. I am having weird stuff with iOS devices syncing, both my iPad and my iPhone, which are both on the current version of iOS 5. It's an iPhone 4S and an original iPad, if that matters. So when I connect them to my Mac via USB to dock connector cable, as I always have, they sync fine. But the over-the-air syncing, I have not had great luck, or Wi-Fi syncing, I've not had great luck with. I have seen it happen a couple of times, but in general, when I plug my iPhone into its power brick, which is plugged into the wall, and it's charging, and it is on the same Wi-Fi network as my Mac, it doesn't sync. And if I go into the options for wireless syncing, all I see is a menu that basically says, yeah, when this is on the same Wi-Fi network with your Mac, it can sync wirelessly. And I look at that and shake my fist and say, but it is on the same Wi-Fi network as my Mac. In fact, it's even through a Wi-Fi network generated by an Apple AirPort Extreme, which otherwise seems to work fine. So, I can get data and so forth. Any suggestions for why this might be the case? Because it would be awful nice to have it just sync when I plug it in. But so far, no dice. This is where you cut me off.
Awesome. Okay, I think I've got the answer for you, Andy. I ran into this myself, especially for people that and which is most of us, people that had iOS devices before iOS 5 and before all of this wireless syncing, there is a setting in iTunes. So the one that you talk about, Andy, where you set that it's going to sync is fine. But two other things need to be set. Number one, go into iTunes, go into your devices just on the left and click on your iPhone or your iPad. And on that first summary screen that appears where you get to pick whether it backs up to iCloud or backs up to this computer, and then you set all these options. The second one is the one that you talked about. Sync this iPhone or iPad over Wi-Fi, and that's going to be checked. But here's the magic that allows it to happen automatically when it's applied, when power is applied. And that is the first one in under options, which is open iTunes when this iPhone or iPad is connected. Completely unintuitive, but without that being checked, your computer is not actively looking for that device to be connected, and it is not going to automatically sync. So there is no way to tell it to sync automatically with power without checking the open iTunes when this iPad is connected box. Weird. Crazy, John. But that is the magic answer. Unless you go into preferences. So iTunes preferences, and then go all the way out to devices, which is the second to last one, and make sure the prevent iPods, iPhones, and iPads from syncing automatically box is not checked, because that too will obviously impact its ability to do that. Crazy stuff. Do you have yours doing Wi-Fi syncing, John?
You know, I think there's another facet to this, and I'm looking right now. So I think I understand his problem here. So
yep.
If you look on the iDevice, so right now I have my iPhone and I'm in settings, general, and there's an explicit selection here, iTunes Wi-Fi sync. Right?
Yes.
And I think I understand his confusion, because what it says on the screen, it says automatically sync with iTunes on your computer when your iPhone is plugged into power and connected to Wi-Fi.
Right.
And it sounds like it's not. Now, also on this screen is a button that if you press, it will sync now. So,
and that will work whether or not you have the checkbox in iTunes that says open when connected. Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's his issue, is that box.
Yeah. I'm 99% certain, checked. Andy. Yeah.
Okay. And then, of course, the other oddness is that the if you're on iCloud, it will sync to iCloud if you plug it into power.
It will back up to iCloud.
Or backup, yes.
Yeah.
Which is different, but it's also something that the device has to be plugged in and has to be connected to Wi-Fi
right.
in order to initiate that operation.
Right. Now, one other thing while we're on this, and then we'll move on to Keith's question because it's related. Once you switch your backup from the computer to iCloud, your iOS device no longer backs up to your computer regularly. Now, this can be a problem, especially if you've gone into your iOS device into the iCloud usage. And we've talked about this previously, where you can actually set. I think you go into settings, iCloud at the bottom, storage and backup. And then I think it's manage storage. And then you click on your device in backups, and you can decide which programs data you don't want to back up. So you can opt certain things out. Well, the problem is if you opt it out, it's not backed up anywhere because your iPhone or iPad isn't backing up to your computer anymore, but you can force it to by simply going in iTunes and choose and right click on the device in the little menu where your library and all that is over there on the left. And choose backup. That will make it backup locally as opposed to up to iCloud. So you can force it to make a local backup, which is a handy thing to remember to do. Is that way you've got it, just in case. Right? Good?
Right.
Okay. Keith time.
Uh-oh. And you know what that means?
I do.
I'm going to take your baton away, Dave.
Take the baton. Run with it.
And here we go. Keith writes, "Hi, John and Dave." I'm glad he put me first. "I have an iPhone 4S that syncs to a Mac Mini in my house. However, when I access either of my two other Macs on the local network and launch iTunes, my phone appears in that corresponding iTunes window and tries to sync to that Mac. I'm thinking that it might be related to the fact that my account names and short usernames are the same on all three machines. But I was hoping you could confirm before I try to change them. Also, I've never had to change an account name or short username, and I really don't want to mess it up. Additionally, toggling the sync with this iPhone over Wi-Fi button in iTunes changes the setting across all the machines, not just the one the iPhone is syncing to, no matter what machine toggles the button. I've also tried permanently deleting any backups that inadvertently get made on any other machine, but it doesn't seem to help either. This is extremely frustrating because I love Wi-Fi syncing, but I hate having to turn my phone into airplane mode before launching iTunes on any other machine. Thanks in advance for any help you can give. Dave?
Yes. Oh, me. Okay.
We'll get the cadence going here.
That's right. So I'm actually, I have this problem too, because, and I think he's right. I never thought about this before, but I bet it is that I have the same short username on both and or on, you know, on multiple machines, and that's how it's getting confused. But regardless, I don't want to change mine either, and I'm not going to. He's right. When you set that box that we talked about, that sync over Wi-Fi, that's actually, even though you make that setting in iTunes, the setting is stored on the device. So it will try and do that no matter what iTunes it connects to. But as we mentioned in the last answer, that little box in iTunes preferences, so iTunes preferences devices, you can check the prevent any iPods or iPads from syncing to this computer box, and that will do it. It's sort of a baby with the bathwater approach. Hopefully you don't have any anything that you would want to sync with that machine versus your other machine, but that should do it. I hope.
Me too.
All right, good. Andrew is next, and Andrew asks, I have a bunch of files to back up to DVD-R, 97.19 gigabytes, in fact. Do you guys know of an app or an Apple script maybe to tell me what will fit instead of doing it all myself? Forklift used to work really well for this, but in the second version, they changed how they do file sizes, and it doesn't anymore. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Okay, he wants to just span data across multiple DVDs, and he doesn't want to have to think about how do I fit this much on this one and then this much on that one, and he just wants the software to do it. And Toast will do that. Toast from Roxio, which is now owned by Corel, Toast Titanium for the Mac has this feature in it. In fact, it's sort of an automatic thing. You build a disk that's way larger than a disk could actually be, and when you hit burn, it'll just start spanning disks. And from what I've seen, it works really, really well. I did this with some stuff actually a number of years ago, and it worked great. But I confirm the current version has that too. They also have audio spanning. So if you have more songs than would fit on an audio CD and you want to burn it, it'll do the same kind of thing. And it'll just keep chunking them up so that you've got a string of CDs that have all the songs on them in the order that you set. But you didn't have to worry about who fit where and all of that stuff and where to cut it off. It's good stuff.
I got more.
Okay.
I got not one, but two additional items.
Yeah.
So one I found is a program called, surprise, DVD Spanner. Here's the good news. So I found something called DVD Spanner that will do exactly this. It will split up. The media into 4-something gigabyte chunks, and it'll spread it across DVDs.
Awesome.
That's the good news.
Yeah.
We'll link to this, of course. The bad news is it doesn't work on Lion.
Oh.
So, but then here's better news. So that's one program that I found, but then I found another one, and I'm so excited about this one because it's called Disco.
Disco. I like that name. That's good.
And the www.discoapp.com, and it even has a picture of a little disco ball. I mean, it couldn't get more exciting. And it looks to do a lot of things here, and it seems to be free. You have to punch in a license code, but it seems to be free. And one of the features it mentions here is, yes, spanning. So I'm surprised then. And apparently, yeah, both of these options are free, though I'm sure with either of them, I'm sure they would encourage or enjoy a donation.
Yeah, this is a Disco looks good.
Well, at least their disco ball.
Their website looks good. Yeah, and they've got a nice icon, so that's nice. That's good. Austin Sarner is one of the authors of this. Why do we know Austin Sarna. That name sounds familiar. He's App Zapper.
Wow, you're good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And
that other name looks familiar too. Okay. So these are, I guess, well-known.
Yeah.
Mac app developers.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. No kidding. That's awesome. All right. I want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Gazelle at gazelle.com. This is a fun website. Just go there. And if you have any electronics that are just laying around, maybe an old iPod, maybe an old iPhone, maybe soon Apple will announce the iPad 3 and you'll want to unload your iPad 2, you can go to Gazelle and get a price for what your device is. You just type in the device. It asks you some questions to qualify it. You know, if you type in iPad, it's going to say, well, how much storage does it have? And then what condition is it in? And do you have the original cables that you want to send in with it? And then they'll give you a price. And once they show you the price, you can, if you say, yeah, that sounds great, you can actually have them, they'll send you a box most of the time. And you get a box all at their expense. You pack your thing into it. You send it off. They evaluate it when they get it to make sure that it matches. If it's better than what you said, they actually will give you more. If it's worse than what you said, they will offer to give you less. If their amount is different, regardless, whether it's more or less, they will ask you if you want to go ahead with things or if you just want them to ship the thing back to you. And it goes from there. In fact, David wrote last month, listener David wrote, I just upgraded my wife's as well as myself to iPhone 4S's from the 3GS model. One we passed on to our youngest daughter and the other we sent off to Gazelle. They gave us a price online of $120 for the phone. But once they received it, they upped the payoff to $132 because of the condition it was in. Nice little gift. And he says he was going to go spend that at Macworld. So they do a good job over there at Gazelle. I've sent some stuff to him. One little trick is I think they let you hold your quote for 30 days. So you may get a higher quote on something if you were to get it before the announcement of its replacement. So, you know, that bear that in mind and maybe you can play around with Gazelle a little bit and see if you can't get it to work to your advantage before Apple announces anything when all the rumors say they are, things are coming up early in March, I think is what the rumors say. So anyway, that is Gazelle at gazelle.com. Mr. Braun.
Yes, Mr. Hamilton. Oh, we're going on to Tim.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell because that's in the
agenda there.
All right, but I'm not going to tell you about the agenda because you can't see it, nor do you want to see it.
It's no, you really
cryptic
don't.
With all these codes and. Here we go, dear John. So Tim writes, dear John and Dave, I'm new to the Apple world. Welcome, but love the. And I think he says, but love the iOS devices, but I think and love the iOS devices. I started with the iPhone 4 and now have the 4S and an iPad 2. I use my iOS devices for everything and have almost completely stopped using my PC. No iMac yet. Love the podcast. I've learned a lot in a short time. However, I still use my PC for creating and updating my website. It is just a basic website for my hobby. I create it using an old FrontPage 2000 and upload it to a Tiger Direct domain. My question, is there an app or way to create and maintain a basic website on the iPad and or iPhone? I'm willing to start from scratch if necessary and also change domain hosting, whatever it takes. I just want to be able to make corrections and updates via iPhone and iPad. Also, I use the what you see is what you get on front page. I understand basic HTML code, but don't create that way. Any help would be greatly appreciated. Sent from Tim's iPhone. So,
naturally, I mean, if he wants to do everything on his iOS device, we would expect that the email would have come from an iOS device. And it did. So that's a good thing.
I've seen more humorous taglines there. What does our friend Duffy had? Sent from the microscopic keyboard on my iPhone, I think he had at one point, which I thought was pretty hilarious. It's kind of a challenge to type in that thing sometimes. So I looked into this, Dave, and I found that there are a number of tools here. I haven't actually tried them, but looked at the apps. Well, I tried one of them. So I'm going to mention three different things here. So, oh gosh, let me navigate to it. Oh no. Let me get the right file. Okay, here we go. So, one, I did find what appears to be a pretty nice HTML editor for iPad, and it's called, and it looks to be only for iPad, not for iPhone.
Okay.
If you're going to be doing this sort of work, I think the iPhone could be a challenge. But it's called Markup for iPad, and it's $9.99. And we will link to that. And looking at the screenshots, he says, well, yeah, it's an app that lets you connect to your website and edit the text files within. So one requirement is that you need an FTP connection, which I would assume you have if you're, you know, hosting it with someone. And I think they added SFTP, which is kind of nice. But looking at the screenshots, it looks like it's more than just editing the text in that it looks to be somewhat graphical. So...
cool.
In some cases, it looks like raw text editing. In other cases, it looks like it gives you a preview, you know, some sort of graphical preview.
Yeah.
So, you know, for $10, it sounds like a good deal. Now, another option, which should work on both the iPad and the iPhone or any iDevice, if you want to get a little down and dirty, and it sounds like he'd be willing to do that. So even though he's using FrontPage, of course, what it creates, I think for the most part, is regular HTML. And I found an app called FTP on the Go. By Headlight Software, $6.99. So it's an FTP client. And again, if you look at the screenshots here, which, you know, nice work, they'll show, oh, well, one of the things that you can do with this is edit HTML files. And they mentioned this, and other users over it say that they do that as well. So option number two, and then option number three. And now this one, I actually created a little website here. I'd never heard of this before. So this is part of the fun when we research the requests here is we all learn something. And it's a little app here called Zapped, Z-A-P-D. I guess it's Zapped, right?
Sure. Let's
go
with
that. Here's what it is. It's an application. It runs on, and I downloaded it onto my iPhone. So you start it up. You got to create an account with them. And then you literally, no, I won't say literally. Well, I already did. Sorry. But you can create a fully functional website just using this program. So there are some limitations in order to allow you to do this. So one, you got to pick from what I can see from the templates that they offer. And I just did a very simple template that would let you display a photograph. So I said, okay, you know, choose this one template. It then said, oh, okay, well, tell me a photograph you want to show. And I picked one of the photographs that was on my iDevice and then filled in a profile that had some information about me, like my Facebook, my Twitter, some things like that, added some text to the page. But I was amazed that I could do this, you know, on an iPhone. There's not a lot of screen real estate. And then you can even get a custom URL from them. So within like less than 5 minutes, I was able to create a website on their domain. Let me see if do I have it?
Oh, I have it. It's johnfbraun.zapped.net. Zapd.net.
Yep. .net. And this is something that I created in minutes. And it looks pretty nice.
Yeah.
And what I thought was cool is that, I paid nothing, and I have now, you know, fortunately I'm the first John F. Braun to come along, but now I have this URL.
That's awesome.
And if I add more things to it. So, gosh, that looks neat. And I don't know. It sounds like, well, I don't know. And you know, a fourth option when I was, and we'll have to look more into this, Dave. But I did see WordPress.
I was just going to mention that. Yep. I've used
WordPress from what I said. Oh, okay. So you've used WordPress on your iPad, I would assume.
Yeah. You have to set up the site first, but I think you could set up like a site at, you know, WordPress hosted kind of thing. But yeah, once you've got it set up, then the app actually works, and you can pump things into it, right from the app and manage your posts that are up there. It's very specifically for a blog type website, right? I mean, that's what WordPress allows you to create. So don't expect to be building pages that are laid out in custom ways. That's not what you're doing with WordPress. But if that's what you want to do, then WordPress is the answer. Yeah, I would think so.
And you know, I got one more answer for
go.
You.
Go.
Tumblr. And you've probably,
yeah.
I think everybody, but if you're not aware of it, and you know, I've seen some people, I don't know if, so Tumblr is T-U-M-B-L-R, is yet another system. I think I would say it's similar to WordPress, but it's a system where you can publish information on a web page, and
yeah,
you can do text and photos and links you know, I've seen a wide variety. Some people use Tumblr just to publish photos. Some use it as a blog. Some combine it. So, and that's another one where I just looked, and yeah, it's in the you know, it's a free app in the store. So that may be another one you want to explore? Because I don't know if you doing the front page thing and then editing it on the iDevice, I think is something that you probably won't want to tolerate for too much longer. Well, just because front page 2000, I mean, gosh, that's ancient. So,
yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you got it right. You got to get something better. That's right. Well, there you go. We just gave him a bunch of options, which is good. All right. Let's see. Let's go to, how are we doing on time here? Actually, we got quite a bit of, well, not quite a bit, but some cool stuff found. We've got a couple more questions. All right, let's do Jordan, and we'll see where we take it from there. Jordan writes, and this is actually a question we've been asked by several people in variety of ways. So we'll try and abstract this out as we do so that it's applicable to as many of you as possible. But Michael also called him, not Michael Johnston. Of course, now is as good a time as any to stop for a minute and thank Michael Johnston for, he's the one that converts this show into AAC for you and adds all the chapters and the images. And sometimes there's funny images. And so this creates a nice opportunity for Michael to put one right here. But he's very creative about it, but also very helpful because it allows for you to click and link and all of that right while you're listening to the show. But anyway, so thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. But anyway, this question has nothing to do with Michael. Jordan writes, I have a pretty abysmal ISP choice where I live in that I have no fiber, no cable, and no DSL. I am forced to use some sort of wireless. For 2 years, I've been using a local company that uses a Motorola Canopy wireless technology, and the service has been pretty bad, but it interacted with my Airport Extreme fourth generation like I expected, assigned a public IP to my router, and that's it. I'm now trying out Clearwire's WiMAX, and thus far I'm pretty pleased with the speed and consistency. My issue is that, and this again, this issue could be for anyone that has an wired or wireless internet service where the ISP provides the router to you. So moving on, he says, my issue is that the supplied Motorola modem wants to be my router too. It has a DHCP server and NAT routing that conflicts with the Airport Extreme. When I initially set it up, the airport utility gave me a double NAT error indicating I needed to either turn off NAT on the modem or switch the Airport Extreme to bridge mode. Long story short, you can't disable NAT on the modem from my Clearwire company, but I can disable DHCP. So now here's how I have my network set up. The Motorola modem is running NAT and has a 10.0.1.2 DMZ address with no firewall on. The LAN address of the modem is set at 10.0.1.1. The airport base station is set to get all the traffic from the modem using the DMZ protocol and is only set to run a DHCP server by selecting distribute a range of IP addresses, with the basic base range being set at 10.0.1.3 to exclude the modem in the base station. Okay. So he says, I have two questions. I have an iMac and Apple TV wired directly to the Airport Extreme base station that are working great, but another Apple TV, Xbox 360, and network TV tuner are behind a standard Ethernet switch. These devices are not receiving IP addresses from the airport and don't work if I set them up with static IP addresses either. Number two, is there any advantage to using the Airport Extreme to run DHCP? Psychologically, I think is what he meant to write here. I don't believe physiologically is the right thing, but anyway, he says, physiologically, I feel that I am letting the better, in my opinion, hardware do as much as possible and will give the best network performance as possible. Am I crazy? Am I overcomplicating this setup? Should I just let the modem run DHCP and NAT and let my base station run in bridge mode? My very, very short answer to what I'm sure will be a slightly longer discussion. Yes. Let whatever the first router is on your network, unless you have some very specific reason not to do this, let one router or one device be the router and the DHCP server and just let it do its thing and let your Airport Extreme just work in bridge mode. And I really think life is going to be easier for you. That's my feeling on it, because otherwise it's too much confusion. I used to have, I'd have my router just passing traffic through, and then I had a Linux machine that was doing DHCP and DNS, and it felt great to configure all this stuff because it was a lot of fun. But it was just a management nightmare, and life's been so much simpler. And it's been like 5 years now since I gave up on that setup. But now that the router's just doing everything, I'm way happier. So I don't know about your thoughts on this, John, which is of course why we're here.
No, you don't know them. No. I'm still trying to picture this. It'd be nice if I had a diary, because it seems we got a number of pieces here.
Let me see if I can explain.
So he mentions that he has, all right, so he's got this Motorola thing. He's got an Airport Express and mm-hmm. he has also a Ethernet switch. Are those the three pieces?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. Do you want me to explain it or are you good? There's a pregnant pause here. So that's why I'm asking.
I'm just thinking if anything's going to, is there any downside to putting the Airport Express in bridge mode?
No. Other than it is now no longer the thing managing DHCP on his network. But I think that's the right move.
Oh, well, yeah, as long as one of the other devices is doing that, then yeah, you're
yeah.
good.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, you know, as far as better hardware and all of that, DHCP, and for those of you following along at home, DHCP is the way that the router assigns addresses and passes pertinent information about the network along to all of your devices. It's essentially what lets you say, I want to connect to this Wi-Fi network on your iPhone, and the rest is just magically taken care of. That's what DHCP does. But that's not really a processor-intensive operation in terms of what a router has to do. Frankly, the more intensive operation, although this isn't all that bad either, is the actual routing, where there's traffic passing up and down and back and forth, and it has to kind of figure out, okay, I'm going to send this here, I'm going to send this there. That's the more intensive thing. And at least in Jordan's situation, you're stuck with your WiMAX device doing that, because that's what they've built it to do. So just let it do everything. It's not going to hurt it. And it's not going to make it any worse. It'll just make it easier to manage.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a reason it warns you about double NAT. I mean, I suppose you could set it up. I believe the Express will let you set up a different NAT range.
Yeah, but you don't want that.
Right, right.
It's bad.
Yeah, there's no reason to do double NAT.
No.
It could only lead to problems.
Yeah, you don't want two machines or two routers essentially routing with one routing for the other. It's different than like going to a baseball game and one guy roots for the other team. It's not the same as rooting and routing. One is good, one is bad. One router per network. Unless you really have a reason to segregate things, but most of us do not, myself included. All right, let's move to Rob's second one down there, John. Is there anything in the middle there you want to grab? If there is, say so now, or there's
well, let's look here. Oh, because I was getting ready for Rob.
Yeah. All right, we'll do Rob. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, do Rob. We'll do two Robs in a row. You do the first one.
Okay. All right. So from Rob, hi, John and Dave. Everybody says John first. That just warms my heart. I just noticed that. All right, here we go. On my Mac Mini running Lion, it runs a program that needs a permanent connection to a couple of AFP shares on two storage servers. The servers are kind of RAID servers called Unraid from Lime Technology and are capable of sharing using SMB and AFP. The shares are being mounted using a scripted login. The script prevents mounting when the server is not seen on the network and is also used on two MacBook Pros. I think that's what he's saying there. What I'm looking for is a way to automatically mount the shares when the connection to the server or servers have been restored. In other words, after a reboot of the servers without restarting the Mac Mini or re-log into the Mini. Searching the internet only gives solutions for auto-connect on login. I hope you guys have a solution for me because I think I really need a geek solution. Oh, well, that's... Oh, that warmed my heart. That's nice. Well, we're not going to have a geek solution. We're going to have a solution that makes sense, right?
Yeah, but I think it's going to be geeky.
Well, it could be geeky. All right. It's geeky in the sense that, yeah, you're going to have to put some pieces together here. But I think I found the right pieces. And so I wrote back to him and I suggested what follows. So one, I found a very nice article over at Macworld that has not one, not two, but and it's called 10 different ways to connect to servers. And specifically, so I thought this would just be fun to look at in general. It has a lot of good tips here. But one way you can connect to a server is, and it has their choice, they call it the scripter's way. And it's using an Apple script. So that's certainly a way to connect to a server. So that's item number one. Now, item number two, how do you get... Now, of course, you can manually double-click on an Apple script, but it sounds to me like that's not what he wants to do. So I think we've touched on a solution like this in the past before. So the question that presents itself is, well, how do you get the Mac to try to do this on a regular basis? Which I think is, at least to me, that's one way to solve this problem. Now, you could say, yeah, it's wasteful. I mean, you're trying to connect to something and, you know, you keep trying to do the same thing, you know, every minute or every 10 minutes or however often you want to schedule it. And isn't that kind of wasteful? And I guess it is, but I don't know of any other way to accomplish this. And my suggestion was there is something, I haven't used it in a while. I think you've used it more recently than me, Dave, called Chronix.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs what's known as a cron job, which is in Unix, basically a process that you can say, keep doing this at regular intervals. That's my solution, would be to get Chronix to run this Apple script.
I have another one.
Go, because, I don't know. This seemed somewhat primitive. I think it'll get the job done, but you may have a better way.
I definitely have a better way. I'm just stumbling onto it now. I did not know about this until we started researching this. So Leopard introduces something called AutoFS. And... So this has been in existence since 10.5. AutoFS is essentially a way to tell the OS, I want this file system to be mounted all the time. And and there's a white paper on it that Apple put together, and it's a Unix thing, so you have to create it's called an FS tab. And honestly, I don't know what, I always forget what FS tab stands for, but you have to create a description of what you want the drive to look like. We'll link to this PDF. I was kind of hoping that someone had built a GUI for this, you know, where you could just go in and say, I want to do this. And then it would just build all these text files for you. But I can't seem to find anything like that. We will link to this. And so, yeah, it's this thing and you edit this file and you tell it, I want this file system to be mounted here. And magically it just takes care of it. And it looks like, from what I can tell here, you just, you know, once you've gone through the configuration, it doesn't look that bad, but it's not totally easy either. I think you can, you know, I think there's actually something in server admin. So if you had Lion server, that you could do this. So Apple has built a GUI utility for it, but it's only included in server, although I believe it is the capability to do this is in everything. So there you go.
A third option.
Yep.
Like, because it sounds to me like this happens. I don't know if iCal. You can schedule an event to occur at regular intervals. The problem with iCal is that, as far as I can tell, the level of granularity, you can only get it down to, I think it's like once a day.
Okay.
So if you do an iCal event, there's a repeat field, and you can say every day, week, month, year, or custom, but I can't figure a way to get custom lower than a day. And then in the alert section in iCal event, you can say, oh, well, you know, send a message, do an email, open a file, or run a script. So if you only need to do this once a day, you could set up an iCal event to launch this Apple script once a day.
Yeah.
It sounds like what you're proposing is more elegant.
What I'm proposing is more elegant, but not in terms of configuration. It's, you know, it's using an OS service. So it's, yeah, like you said, it's more elegant, but what you're talking about is probably more attainable and more manageable. So I would do the Chronix way of just scripting the Apple script, because that's kind of what AutoFS does based on based on my very brief investigation of it here, is it kind of on a regular basis or anytime it detects network changes? You know, that's the beauty of using LaunchD is you can set different events to be the trigger, as opposed to with Chronix, you're just setting the time. Although, will Chronix let you manipulate LaunchD now? I think it will. So, but maybe no. I think it's just crontab. That's right. So yeah, you're just doing time. So, you know, you might be able to build a, what are those called? The, a launch agent, right? And put that in, and build that and then install it with Lingon. That would be another way of doing it.
All right.
You know what I mean?
Well, that's another one. Yeah. Because Lingon, when you define, okay, good one. Yeah. So that, that lets you define tasks that'll.
Yeah.
Though I'm wondering, cause that's more, I'm wondering about that. No, I think it'll let you do it because, I mean, definitely we know this, especially from people where software has not, you know, fully removed itself. What happens is that if a LaunchD job, if you set it up to launch it when it dies, then you'll get all this garbage in the console. So right. I'm wondering if doing it that way, if it's smart enough to know that a connection has been lost. Or you just, yeah, like similar to Chronix, you just set it up so it always, it tries to do this on a regular basis.
Right.
And if it's mounted, then and you try to mount it again, it shouldn't do any harm.
Yep.
It's just kind of wasteful.
Yep. Right. Right. Cool. Yeah. AutoFS. We'll put a link out there, John. I'll send you the PDF I found if you haven't found it already for yourself, but,
no, I haven't found it.
All right. It's just a PDF. So, all right. Let's see. Let's move on to another question from another Rob. Oh no, I got to pull this up. Okay. Rob writes, and this is a question I kind of want to pass along to the group here because I don't have a magic answer for it, but I think amongst our family, the Mac Geek Gab extended family, that somebody's going to have this. He says, I haven't been able to find an app for this, so I'm wondering if you know of something that will do the following. Like in the TV series 24, I want to be able to send data from my iPad or iPhone to a Mac screen and vice versa. For example, if I'm looking at a web page and want to share it with my wife, I can send her the link to her iMac and she can open it in her browser. Ditto for text or PDFs, etc. Any ideas on an app that can do this? So I think we've got to sort of abstract back from the concept of doing this as an app, but more into the concept of doing it as a workflow. And the reason is what I was going to say is there's no real way of having something running on your iPad that will, or iPhone, that will collect data from every app, right? Each app is sort of autonomous that way, but you could set something up in a print way that allowed things to move back and forth. So I don't know the magic answer, but I know that there are people out there that do this and they constantly move things between their two devices. So send in your ideas and then we'll share the more creative ones here in a future show. Do you have any thoughts on this? Otherwise, we got to tell them how to share their ideas with us, John.
No thoughts.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, for all of you out there, you're going to want to email feedback@macgeekgab.com with your ideas.
I want to make sure I heard you right, Dave. I do believe that you said feedback@macgeekgab.com.
I did. I said feedback@macgeekgab.com. You can send in email, pictures, videos, text, obviously, and you can even attach an audio file. So that's one way of getting to us. The other is to call us at 206-666-GEEK, which is
4335.
Oh, look at that. You can visit macgeekgab.com to see the show notes, of course, for the show. And you can leave comments on individual shows there. And that has been a great place of some discussions in the past, and especially following up after a show. So that would work for this too. You can Skype us to Mac Geek Gab. That works. Anything else?
Facebook.com/Mac Geek Gab.
Yep.
And unfortunately, you can only like us, I think.
They can't love us there.
Or tolerate us. They only have, it's just, you know, it's still kind of wishy-washy. Actually, you know, I've had a lot of people, not that anyone would do this, but I have had a lot of people actually suggest that Facebook should have an unlike option.
Ah, like not a, well, there is an unlike option, right? If you like a page, you can then unlike it and go back to neutral ground. But I think what you're talking about is something where you can actually go one step below neutral ground.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And lastly, iTunes comments.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Yeah.
You can give us stars and you can do text.
And that's about it there. You can find us on Twitter. Twitter.com/MacGeekGab for announcements regarding the show. Twitter.com/John F. Braun for that guy over there. Twitter.com/Dave Hamilton for me. And Twitter.com/Pilot Pete for Pilot Pete. But he's not here today. All right. So that's send to screen. I'm curious about people's workflows. I bet we're going to learn a lot as people write in about that, you know, because he's got a good point. You know, it's a frustrating thing to be viewing a web page on your Mac and say, okay, now I want to read this on the iPad, or especially vice versa. Email works, but it's so clumsy to do that with. So I'm looking for creative elegance here. That's what we're after. Okay. I don't know about this one, this next one. Well, let's skip that. I'm going to skip that for a week. Simon had an interesting thing.
I don't know about Simon. Well, you go.
Okay. Actually, sorry. I have the name wrong. We'll go. We'll leave it.
Oh,
as
no,
Simon.
No. Oh, that's
no,
right.
No,
oh,
no, no. We'll leave it as Simon. Trust me on this for this one. Simon writes, in show 379, John advised Brian to install 2 2-gig chips in his Core 2 Duo MacBook. John recommended 2 2-gig chips rather than 1 2-gig chip and another 1 gig chip in order to gain the benefits of interleaving and 128-bit addressing and all of that stuff. Either way, John said Brian's MacBook would be able to access a maximum of 3 gigabytes of the installed RAM. And as Simon writes here, the best reason to install 2 2-gigabyte chips in this machine is because it is, in fact, capable of accessing all 4 of those gigabytes once the machine is upgraded to Lion. And Brian did say that he was running Lion. I have a slightly older, slightly slower MacBook, a late 2006 2 gigahertz Core 2 Duo with 2 2-gigabyte chips, a couple of years old. And I did this because of the interleaving benefit, but only had 3 gigs available. Then I upgraded to Lion. Lo and behold, my old MacBook could see all 4 gigabytes, and I've even included a screenshot to prove the point. And sure enough, he did. So this is interesting. It didn't make sense to me that Lion lifted this restriction, but I take his screenshot at face value because why wouldn't I? This is an interesting one. I think, John, you said you were going to reach out to OWC and see if we can't get him to...
You know, here's the
comments on.
Ooh, whoa.
Hello.
Voice is cracking. Here's the thing, though. So the screenshot that we were sent was about this Mac.
Uh-huh.
Now, what I asked Simon, we're going to say, to do for us, though, is I'm not convinced that that value represents the amount of usable memory. Because I did some reading on this, and the information that's out there, including the information from multiple vendors, is that the particular class of machine that we identified is, in fact, although you can put 4 gigs in, can only use 3. So as a follow-up, what I asked, and what I think this will clinch it here, is so we definitely see in about this Mac that it says 4 gigs. There's no question about that. What I'd like to know is that if and I think Simon will get back to us on this. If you go to Activity Monitor, there's a System Memory tab, and that shows you a slightly different view. And I'm curious if that also says 4 gigs or if it says 3 gigs. And there's one or two places you can look. There's two. So either you're going to see that there's 2 figures here that should add up to the total memory in the machine, and it's used and free, right?
Right, right, right.
And then there's the graph to the right. There's a little pie chart. And oddly enough, now this is, oh, I know why. Check this out. You know, I just looked at mine.
Uh-huh.
On my Mac Mini.
Uh-huh.
It says 7.75.
Because your Mac Mini, you're using a quarter of a gig for video RAM.
Right. You know, I was just looking at me. Wait a second. I don't have 7.75 gigs of memory in there. I got 8. And you're absolutely right, Dave. Yeah. Oh, I hadn't seen that before.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The number
on my MacBook Pro, it shows me 6 because that machine has 6 and it has its own VRAM. So that's very interesting that that pie chart reflects the or subtracts the VRAM.
So your theory here, and you may be right about this, is that, and I just want to get this right, that Lion is more intelligent about reporting what chips are installed in about this Mac, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's allowing you to address all 4 gigs as usable RAM.
Correct. And that's where I think
you could be
that's
right.
Where I think the end of it, because I mean, I did a bit of surfing and I didn't find anybody saying Lion all of a sudden gave me the ability to utilize more RAM, because my understanding is that this limitation is not a limitation of the operating system, but it's a limitation, I think, of the firmware or maybe the particular processor, class of Intel processor.
I thought it was the memory bridge, like the but whatever. Yes, there's something on the motherboard that says no go. That was my interpretation too. Yeah.
So if anybody else out there has, so the specific Mac that we're talking about, if anyone has a MacBook out there, and your machine is one that identifies itself. So if you go to System Profiler or More Info, and when you look under Hardware and then Model Identifier, it should say, I think it's Mac or MacBook 2.1, I think it is. This is the specific class of machine that, as far as I can tell, can only utilize 3 gigs of RAM.
Right.
So if anybody else has this class of machine and they're running Lion, if you could give us the numbers, I'd like to settle this. Because Either, because two sources of info told me that this machine can only see 3, both Mac sales, and I trust these guys, you know, have pretty good info. And,
yeah.
And Mac Tracker also, that software also says, well, this machine only sees 3.
Yeah. Interesting. But you do get at least in theory, you get a speed benefit by putting
there's no downside except a slight financial one to having... Right. 2 twos versus a 2 and a 1. Yeah, you definitely want to do it. Now, I think there was an exception that I think in some of the MacBook Pros, like I think our model actually, Dave, I think ours does not like having 2 4s in it, right? I know there was one iteration where you had to put a 2 and a 4 in it. Yeah,
right.
We have the MacBook Pro early 2008, and I think this machine.
I'll let
you
keep saying
we,
but we really don't.
Oh, you don't have it anymore. You sold it or
no? Well, I do. I have it. I'm trying to think who's using it. I guess my daughter's using that now that I've got my Air. Yeah, I still have it, but
because I thought I heard that putting 2 4s in that machine would confuse it.
I think that's right. Yeah, yeah.
All right.
You know, at Macworld Expo, one of the things that we talked about and we even gave an editor's choice award to was this cool thing from Lantronics called the X Print server. And I got one, I guess it arrived Tuesday. So I've been able to play with it a little bit, and the device, it works. It does exactly what it's supposed to do. You plug it into your network. It has 2 ports on it, power and Ethernet. That's it. So you just plug it into your network. It went out. It found my networked HP LaserJet 3055. And now from here in my, you know, iPad or whatever, I can go and say print and it just shows up. And it's an option to print. And I can select the printer. I'm doing this here. And it just shows up. HP LaserJet 3055, X Print server, and off you go. And it just prints it. And I've printed a bunch of things with it. It's worked really, really well.
Huh.
There is a web page. It registers itself on your network as Bonjour. And so you can go to, I think it's, you know, XPrint server or something .local and you can configure it, you know, but you don't need to. There's nothing really special to configure. I mean, you can change its name and you can change the name of your printers and all of that. But for the most part, you just leave the thing alone and it just works right out of the box. So really, really cool. And I think it's like $150. So it's good stuff. The one thing I will point out about it, and this is, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, it's too bad when people do this to a product. So I get the thing and it has its power adapter. So it's got in the box is the device, which is not that big, maybe, you know, about the size of an iPhone, but like two or three of them stacked on top of each other, but it's, you know, relatively small. And then there's an Ethernet cable, which is great. And then there's this power cable. And then there's some adapters to make the power cable work in Europe or elsewhere. Hmm. Great. So I left the adapters alone. I plugged everything in and then I went to apply power. And it was one of these power bricks, which has the prongs that kind of flip out of it and usually fit real well at the end of a surge protector strip.
Right.
You know, right. OK, so you know what I'm talking about. So I go to plug it in and there's, you know, one wide open hole at the end of the strip. And I'm like trying to get it. And the thing keeps folding back into itself. I'm like, what is going on? And then I realized that it is not a standard one of these, but the prongs actually go to the middle of this device, not to the top of it like you would normally expect. And I think it's because of all these other adapters for different countries or whatever, and they built this thing. But the problem is it takes up two or three. Actually, it would take up three. If you put it in the middle of a power strip, it would take up three spots just for itself. So it's like, you know, you built this great device and then you outsource to this crummy, you know, I'm sure they didn't build this power cable. I'm sure they just, you know, said, oh, great. We can, you know, source a bunch of these cables that work in any country. Beautiful. Check, you know, works anywhere. But it's just like, you know, you could go a little bit further and make sure the thing works. So that's my one little fish shake at it. Cause I had to go get an extension cord to make this thing work. But otherwise, it works great.
Huh. And the way it works, if I recall, is so you have to connect to it using Wi-Fi with your iDevice.
No, not at all. It just sits. It is not a Wi-Fi device. It is a network device. And all it does is it goes on the network and finds printers. And then it advertises those printers as iOS printers the same network. So wired machine.
When I was, when I got a demo of it, I was connected. Okay. I when they demoed it to me, their only network was the device.
No.
Or they had a Wi-Fi access point and they had this on their own network.
Okay. That's right.
No, I got it.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you do have to connect wirelessly, but that's a limitation of your iOS device.
Right.
You know, because there's
okay. Now I understand. I thought I was connecting to their. Though I thought their device could connect to other Wi-Fi enabled printers.
Sure, if a printer is, it will connect to any network printer that is set up on your network,
and whether it be
doesn't care.
Wired or wireless.
Correct.
And then if you're on the same network, then all of a sudden you can see these on your iDevice. Okay.
That's right.
All right. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah, no, it's good stuff. It's cool.
Amazing. It's funny that, you know, such kind of, to me, such a glaring omission in the iOS environment that it took a company to step in and, you know, figure this problem out, which to me, I don't think is a big technical problem. Just for whatever reason, Apple just isn't really interested in letting you print.
I guess. Yeah. And
or
you
make
know,
it easy to print.
So the thing is, I have now printed twice from this thing total. One, the day I got it to test it. And then two right now, because I figured I would go through the steps while we were talking about it. So there's not a lot of times that I would want to print in my home to my iOS, you know, from my iPad or whatever. But there, to be fair, there's also not a lot of homes that have network printers in them. I think you and I are, you know, we're geeks, right? But most people have printers that are just attached to their Macs, and this will not work with those types of printers. You have to have a standalone network printer. It can be on a JetDirect box or something like that, but it has to be set up as a standalone network printer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But
all my printers are network printers.
I know, but you and I, like I said, you and I are geeks.
Yeah, we're yeah.
Yeah. So, but you know, I was at my my son's school the other day for carnival, and I saw a printer. It was a winter carnival, so it was inside. And I saw, you know, they've got printers kind of spaced in common areas throughout the school. And that's when it hit me. It was like, oh, wow. Well, if this school had a bunch of iPads and the kids were working on stuff and they wanted to print something, this device would be awesome because you just get one of these devices. They say that one device will do about 10 printers. And if you need more printers, you just add more of these devices and then they'll magically sort it out. So, but you know, at one school, they probably don't have more than 10 or maybe 20 printers total. And so, you know, you stack up a couple of these devices and now every printer everywhere in the school is accessible for the iPads. And that is when it starts getting really cool. So
yeah,
definitely, you know, cool stuff found and, just, you know, you got to get an extension cord with it. It's too bad. All right. You want to read, about these, iOS tips, John?
I'm unprepared.
All right. You want me to do it? You want me to do another one while you prepare for that one? You want to let Joe go? Let's let Joe go. And then you'll prepare.
Let Joe go.
All right, cool.
Hey guys, Joe here from Raleigh, North Carolina. But just listening to 376 where you were talking about TripIt, I agree. That's a great, great resource. And I haven't listened all the way through, so you may have mentioned this, but there are a number of other applications or iApps, including one from TripIt Sales, that integrate that with an app on your phone for tracking stuff. And they're all really cool for keeping up with your actual travel plans. What I have found, though, is that there's an application called Travel Tracker Pro. Sorry, that's Travel Tracker Pro. And for a reasonably frequent traveler, this is an absolute awesome app. It's not particularly cheap. I seem to remember that it's in the neighborhood of $15 to $20. But it links with TripIt. Allows you to make changes, upload them back up to the website so that, you know, they're there. But it goes far, far beyond that. It can create packing lists for you if you need such things to help you remember things to pack. It can keep up with expenses in any currency. It can take photographs of receipts and link them with the expense that you're talking about if you happen to need that sort of thing for submitting to work. It just has a number of features. It keeps up with past history, future trips, and it is just a great, great little resource for carrying all that information along with you and not having to carry paper. So anyway, I just wanted to drop that off, put that maybe in your next tips show. I hope you guys are having a great week, and we'll talk to you later. Bye.
Thanks, Joe. I found it for $10, $9.99. So not quite as much as Joe said, and he's right. It's got some good stuff in there. Another one that I would throw into that mix is also $10 is Flight Tracker Pro. Really awesome for keeping track of where flights are, finding alternate flights. The user interface of it makes it worth it alone, and it will pull from TripIt so you can have all your stuff in one spot and all of that. And all of these do not require TripIt Pro. You can do it with the free TripIt version. That you can get just by going to TripIt.com. So, all right. Are we ready for your iOS tips here, John?
I think I have the right one.
Okay.
Oh, no, but it says, hi, Dave.
It's okay.
But I can read. All right. And this is time. Okay. So, hi, Dave. Heard my question on the podcast last week. Appreciate that. Thought I would pass this on. So I'm giving as well as taking. No doubt you already know these. I didn't. But there you go. All three are about the iPhone, in my case, the 4S. And all three come under the heading of, wow, I never knew that, but I bet everyone else does, which is annoying. Well, no, because I didn't know some of these. And actually, I just tried some of these, Dave. So here we go.
Cool.
First one, never knew you could take a photo using the plus volume key.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's well, I'll qualify that is that you have to be in the camera.
Oh, good point. Yes.
Because I just tried it. No, just holding down the plus volume key will, of course, set the volume. So if you're in the camera, there are two ways to take a picture now. I just verified this. So one, of course, is you can press the tiny little camera icon that's on the touch screen. But
yep.
That may be cumbersome or hard to do. Well, yeah, you press the press the plus volume key. That's very nice. Number two, and I don't think I knew either one of these. Never knew you could call someone back when you have missed the call without unlocking the phone by pressing and holding on the missed call notification, then sliding it to the right.
So, yeah, so this is actually interesting. any of those notifications that you get on the lock screen where you have the slide to unlock at the bottom, all of those notifications actually are slidable to unlock the phone and bring you right into the app that generated it. So in this case, the phone app, and it'll go and redial the number. But if you've got, you know, a thing from like, say, you know, a news item from the New York Times, you can swipe that and it'll bring you into the app. If you have a notification from your Twitter app or Facebook app, you swipe that and it brings you right into the app. So, yeah, you can unlock the phone from those things in that list, which is pretty cool.
And the final one. Oh, I like this. Never knew you could use a locked iPhone to make calls even when you don't know the PIN. Just press and hold the home key to invoke Siri and then speak the number. I wonder how much of a security hole that is and how far you can go using Siri with a locked phone. That's a very good question.
Yeah, Siri. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, Siri allows you to bypass all that stuff on the 4S only for obvious reasons because it doesn't have the rest don't have Siri.
Yeah, yeah, same with, you know, taking photos, as we discussed, which I've actually found very handy.
Yeah, although the thing is, taking photos is interesting because if you, so this is another tip, right? If you double tap from the lock screen with iOS 5, the slide to unlock, two things happen. Number one, music shuttle controls appear at the top below the time. And then number two, the unlock slider gets a little bit smaller. And a camera icon appears there. And so this is a way that you can jump right into the camera and be ready to take a picture like lickety split. And you're right. This all happens without unlocking it. But what's interesting is that you can't access your other pictures until you unlock the phone. So you can take pictures.
Yep.
But you can't access others and do anything with them until you unlock the phone. So.
I noticed that because, yeah, I just tried it now and it says your iPhone is locked. Unlock the iPhone because I thought, oh, man, this is a huge, you know, so now I can see pictures on anybody's phone by just double tapping. No, you could certainly take pictures,
right,
and maybe clog up their photo stream with, right, with shenanigans. But
right. Yeah, it's good stuff. This is why we do this, because it's fun. And when you're having fun, the time flies. Believe it or else.
Wow, it did fly. Look at that.
I know. All right. Well, we've talked about how to contact us. We should talk about premium. We've got Mac Geek Gab Premium. It is our little something extra that we offer for the people that want a little something extra and or want to offer some direct financial support for the show. It's $25, gets you 6 months of premium, which includes two extra episodes per month. And that's guaranteed two extra episodes. So if we wind up doing, you know, four regular ones in a month, you get six. If we wind up doing only two regular ones in a month, you get four. So it's, you know, always two extra. You get access to the archives. You get access to premium at MacGeekGab.com, which is the email address that premium members you can use to send email to John and I. And of course, as we say many times, you get our undying gratitude and that warm, fuzzy feeling you get only from supporting your two favorite geeks. So for those of you that are already on premium, thank you. And for those of you that are thinking about it, thank you.
Think harder.
Thank you. You know, a friend of ours who used to run a Mac podcast, but actually now goes and work. He went and worked for Apple. He used to run a hosting business, my friend Corey. And he, on his tech support page, he had something which always makes me laugh. It said something, I'll paraphrase this, and hopefully I'll get it right enough so that it's actually still funny. He said, if you, you know, all tech support calls, he said, you know, he gave like phone number and email, and it was basically him that ran it. And his clients kind of knew this. And it said, all tech support requests will be answered within 2 hours of them being sent in. If you've waited 2 hours and still haven't had a response, wait longer. Thought that was funny. That's good. All right. I think that's it. We're ready to get out of here. We thanked Michael Johnston from We Have Communicators podcast. Go check out that podcast. It's good stuff that he does over there. We'd also like to thank Cashfly, CacheFly.com for the bandwidth. And, of course, the A2U desktop speakers from Audio Engine, BB Edit from Barebone Software, PDF Pen for iPad from Smile and Gazelle are all in the podcast marketplace this month. And John, is there any parting words you'd like to share with the listeners before we disappear for a week?
Of course, don't get caught.
Made up.